This is an ABC podcast.
This is Pacific Beach on ABC Radio Australia. Today, electric cars are being talked up here in Australia, but could they really be the way of the future in the Pacific as nations try to do their bit for climate change?
We are trying to promote smaller three-wheelers for short distances, because most of the Pacific Island countries outside Fiji, distances are not that large, and smaller vehicles could be very, very useful.
Not everyone's so convinced, though, so we're going to take a close look at what research has been done so far and what is already underway. Also coming up on Pacific Beach today, plastic waste in the Pacific, why tourism's being blamed for a large part of the problem, but also how the industry can help fix it. And tributes flow for the Australian academic who spent nearly 50 years in PNG and whose works had a major influence on the understanding of the country's politics.
He's one of a group of academics who has this very deep connection and understanding of our country. So he's not only helped Australia in terms of understanding Papua New Guinea and Papua New Guinea politics, but I know that a lot of students that have studied politics in this country know of Bill's work.
We're going to have more tributes and memories of Dr. Bill Standish coming up later in the program. Hello, I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company. We start, though, in Solomon Islands, where a weekend of heavy political lobbying seen a new group led by the former Prime Minister Manasseh Sogavare sign a coalition agreement that they claim gives them the numbers that are required to form the new government. Now, the agreement between the four political parties is the first coalition deal to be signed as the country waits for the Governor General to call a Prime Minister's election that's required following the national poll nearly 2 weeks ago when 50 MPs were voted in. Now, among this coalition group, are two female MPs, Lynelle Tanningata and Frieda Tuki, who were among 25 women to contest the April the 3rd election. It's the highest number of women to win at one election in Solomon Islands, and advocates say that this result should be celebrated. And for Frieda Tuki, it's a special win, marking her return to Parliament. She says it vindicates her after she was kicked out of office last week, as Evan Wasuka reports.
For Frieda Tuki, winning back the Te Motu Vatu seat was particularly bittersweet. She was removed from office last year after the High Court ruled in favour of a 2014 election petition that accused her of vote buying. It took 4 years for the court to hear it, and it cut her time in office short by several months. Although it disqualified her from contesting in a by-election, which didn't happen because of the short time frame, it didn't prevent her from running in this year's national election. A defiant Ms. Tuki says her win has vindicated her.
It's an achievement for my people, my supporters who know that in 2014 I didn't pay any voters, who were downhearted when I got kicked out with that petition. It proves that what people wanted was to re-elect me back.
Ms. Tuki says during her 4 years, her constituency benefited from improved lighting, health and education. Her constituency of Te Motu Vatu is one of the most remote in Solomon Islands, and she has some big plans lined up.
I need one more ship. If I stay in government, I will try to negotiate for it. For transport, it's still difficult as a remote constituency. For us in the islands, we still don't have wharves for ships to berth on. So these are the areas I want to improve in my constituency.
Ms. Tuki says there were difficulties being one of the 25 women contesting the elections in a male-dominated society.
I prepared myself to be answerable and prove what I did in the past 4 years and how I delivered development projects to people in my time as a leader.
Like more development project for people.
Both Frieda Tuki and Lynelle Tanningata are with the Kandare Party, and although the government forming process is still underway, both are keen to get back in and contribute to nation building.
Two women who served as MPs in the previous term who both won their seats this year. So I do think those kind of really visible examples of female political leadership are important and could bring change in the future.
Dr. Karen Baker is a researcher at the Australian National University and has studied elections and politics in Solomon Islands. Although women MPs only make 4% of parliament, The result of the 2019 elections is a historical one for the women of Solomon Islands.
And it's the first time that more than one woman has won a seat. So it's really exciting. And it is a record election for women. Two women elected, but also a handful of women who came second, who performed really strongly. So even looking beyond the numbers of winners and losers, there's a lot to feel positive about.
Pione Bosso agrees.
It is a starting point where women can work together, yeah? Women can work together and we can rally support to get more women in parliament.
Ms. Bosso works with the Women's Rights Action Movement, an NGO aimed at influencing policy and legislative reforms for women and girls.
Women who have contested the 2019 national general elections have shown that they are confident to try out.
But Ms. Bosso says more women are needed in parliament to influence policy and legislation.
The critical mass that we need to have to influence change is 30%. And so that's something that for Solomon Islands, we also need to work towards.
It's Pione Bosso of the Women's Rights Action Movement in Solomon Islands, ending that report from Evan Wasukum. Politicians from all Australian parties have hit the campaign trail over the weekend and continue today after a date was finally confirmed for the election. Voters will be going to the polls on May 18th to elect their new leaders, making a decision based on what issues are most important to them. And some, such as the Australian Greens Party, have declared that this year's poll will be the climate election. And it is certain that climate, energy and environment policy will be a key point of debate over coming weeks here in Australia. But there'll be people in the Pacific too who'll be watching closely as well. After several regional leaders have publicly made known their disappointment with the current Australian policies, as the ABC's political reporter Alexandra Beach reports.
Across the kitchen table, Labor leader Bill Shorten found this Melbourne couple rate climate change as one of their top election issues.
I just think about your two very handsome little boys, but when they're growing up, what will we have done on climate change?
That's right.
That's what concerns me.
Yeah.
Greatly, really. So, I really think that the emissions reduction and promoting renewables is really important.
Climate change and energy policy are expected to feature strongly in this election campaign. It's an area Mr. Shorten listed as one of his top priorities today.
Take real action on climate change and renewable energy and help push energy prices down.
Greens leader Richard Di Natale has also seized on the issue.
We speak to a lot of people on the ground and they are telling us that unless you've got a serious plan to tackle climate change, we're not interested in supporting you.
But the Prime Minister didn't utter the words climate change once during his speech to kick off the election campaign. And this is an issue where the major parties have taken markedly different paths. Their emissions targets are miles apart. While the coalition's committed to reduce emissions by 26% to 28% from 2005 levels by 2030, Labor wants to cut emissions by 45%. Labor also wants to revive the National Energy Guarantee, which was dumped by the coalition just before the latest leadership spill. Frank Yotso is the head of the Australian National University's Centre for Climate Change, Economics and Policy, and says climate policy is gaining traction with voters.
Climate change in the inner city seats, at any rate, has become an emblem of new thinking versus old thinking, if you want to put it that way. And you have challenges in some of these high-profile Liberal-held seats.
He's hoping there's enough interest in the issue at this election to lead to some measure of bipartisanship after more than a decade of political bickering.
Yeah, Australia is a tremendous example of a country that has every opportunity to shift to zero carbon energy and really lead the world in showing how it can be done, how to build an energy system almost exclusively on cheap renewable energy. And what's been holding us back is really policy uncertainty.
That is Frank Yotso. He's the head of the Australian National University's Centre for Climate Change, Economics and Policy. The reporter there, Alexandra Beach. And as we expect in coming weeks ahead of the Australian election, there will be more debated and announced on the issues of climate change and energy environment policy. And we'll bring you those here on Pacific Beach, as well as Pacific reactions to some of those. Well, meanwhile, electric vehicles are somewhat the talk of town here in Australia, with the Labor Opposition Party hatching a plan to make sure that 50% of all new car sales are electric by the year 2030. It's one of its election policies. Now, it's aimed at rejuvenating the Australian car industry while also trying to battle climate change. It's based on tax incentives for businesses and also a $1 billion research and development grant. While imported secondhand petrol and diesel cars dominate the Pacific's roads, there are some in the region who are confident about the possibilities of electric vehicles. They say they could be an important part of the Pacific's move towards the UN's nationally determined contributions to fighting climate change, as Nick Fogarty reports.
Jump in my car. I wanna take you home.
Because it's a way to tackle climate change, but a lot of people didn't want to start driving electric because there are a lot of prejudices. People think they're not reliable or you cannot cover long distances.
Dutch adventurer Wiebe Wakker has been driving a 10-year-old electric car from Amsterdam across 33 countries to Australia just to prove it can be done. He's still going, charging his vehicle mostly through domestic power sockets and the odd charging station, where he can find them mostly in Queensland or Western Australia. In 2016, just 0.1% of all new car sales in Australia were electric, which is one of the smallest rates in the developed world. Labor opposition leader Bill Shorten hopes to change that, floating a policy with the joint aims of fighting climate change and reinvigorating the country's car manufacturing industry.
I would like to see us make electric cars in Australia, because Australians are top-class manufacturers when you've got a government who gets behind them.
Electric and hybrid vehicles naturally give off fewer carbon emissions and burn less of the world's dwindling supply of fossil fuels. But how do Pacific Island nations fit into this, as a region that emits a tiny fraction of the world's greenhouse gases, but is set to suffer the worst effects of climate change?
We do not have many electric vehicles in this part of the world at the moment, but we are developing solar charging stations and we are testing them out.
Dr. Atul Raturi is a renewable energy expert at Fiji's University of the South Pacific. Prompted by concerns about climate change and the Pacific Islands' reliance on fossil fuels, especially for transportation, he's been part of a team that's looked at the feasibility of electric vehicles in urban areas and tourist resorts.
Now, hopefully in the coming days and coming months, we would have electric vehicles coming in, especially the smaller ones. So we are trying to promote smaller three-wheelers for short distances, because most of the Pacific Island countries outside Fiji, distances are not that large, and the smaller vehicles could be very, very useful.
Fiji's government appears to be on the electric bandwagon itself, with the introduction of several incentives in its 2018-2019 budget. These include a 55% capital deduction for any purchase of an electric vehicle and a 7-year income tax exemption for any business setting up EV charging stations, provided they invest more than $500,000. It's a key plank in the country's nationally determined contributions to fighting climate change, with the overarching goal of having Fiji run entirely on renewable energy by 2030. Other Pacific nations, including PNG and Vanuatu, have set the same target, while Samoa is even more ambitious, aiming to be 100% renewable by 2021. Petrol and diesel cars still dominate these countries' roads, but given their reliance on imported second-hand vehicles, that could change as near neighbours like Australia and Japan move towards electric. Vijay Jasmani runs Sai Motors, one of a number of second-hand Japanese car dealerships in Samoa's capital Apia. He says he has doubts about the feasibility of electric cars in Samoa.
No, I don't think so it will work.
Samoa's transport minister was criticised after introducing a law in 2017 that banned the importation of cars that are more than 8 years old, with some people saying modern cars would be more expensive and harder to repair. The law stands, though, and the mix of cars on the roads of countries like Samoa will continue to be dictated by what's rolling off the production lines in Japan and potentially Australia. But Vijay Jasmani says there'd need to be a big influx of skills and infrastructure into the Pacific to support the widespread use of electric or even hybrid vehicles.
But if that car comes on, they have to bring a nice workshops here so they can fix the cars easily, you know, especially from New Zealand. Many professional guys are there in New Zealand who can fix this type of cars easily.
Samoa's transport department couldn't yet be reached for its thoughts on the future of the country's car import and maintenance sectors. But for renewable energy expert Atul Raturi, the future looks bright.
I can visualize in 20 years down the line, the 30 years down the line, you know, most of the countries would be able to produce their own electricity and hence could run most of their economy. So exciting days ahead. Jump in my car.
That is the song Jump in My Car. And by the sounds of it, people want it to be an electric car, perhaps. That story was from Nick Fogarty. And the last voice we heard there was the renewable energy expert at Fiji's University of the South Pacific, Dr. Atul Ruturi.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
There's a waste crisis happening in the Pacific with rubbish generated taking up limited space that's available for landfill and often ends up in the ocean or being burned, and then it generates pollution. Dependence on packaged imports means that Pacific Islanders actually generate more than twice as much rubbish as most other people in the world. And tourism's one of the major contributors, but it's also an industry that can reduce its footprint by making a few changes to the way that the industry operates, as Bill Bainbridge reports.
The Pacific has built its tourism industry on the image of friendly faces and pristine beaches. But the reality can be quite different, with high levels of rubbish polluting local environments. On average, Pacific Islands generate more than 3 kilos of waste per person per day. That's more than double the world average. But if that sounds like a lot, when tourists visit Pacific Islands, they generate more than double that again, at 7 kilograms for every person, every day. The figures are contained in a new report authored by Dr. Jeff Seedon from Auckland University of Technology. He says the tourist industry has a special incentive to cut the amount of waste it's generating.
You go to lay down on the beach and you're surrounded by various plastic, then it doesn't become so desirable.
And plastics aren't the only problem. Pacific countries struggle to deal with mining and hazardous waste, construction industry waste, and car and truck tyres. And each natural disaster, like a cyclone or earthquake, can generate the equivalent of decades worth of waste.
It sits on those islands because they, in fact, don't have an economic way normally of getting the material off the island or, in fact, reusing it on the islands.
Reusing waste can save anything from $50 per tonne right up to $560 per tonne. But there are measures that can help cut the impact of the waste problem.
Composting the organic matter and then that material can go back into the community. You're doing things like collecting services and organising those so that it just doesn't get dumped outside the house that you happen to be living in. We have proper disposal facilities, even upgrading the dump sites into what's known as semi-aerobic landfills, where air is let in to stop methane being produced, and that also stops toxic leachate being produced when water flows through those sites.
But the greatest impact of all would come from not putting waste into the system in the first place. And to that end, Dr. Seedon says that Western tourists themselves need to be more mindful about their approach to travelling.
Instead of going to your five-star hotel with all the developed countries' facilities, look at how the locals are living and live in that sort of accommodation. It gives you an island experience. Secondly, eat the local food. Why go to the islands if you're just going to continue to eat what you've been eating at home? And then the third thing is, don't litter. If you're carrying around your water bottle, don't just toss it on the side of the road where everyone else has tossed them. Every little bit makes a difference.
CEO of the South Pacific Tourism Organisation, Chris Cocker, says while the industry is aware of the waste problem, it needs support from aid donors to move beyond awareness raising. But he agrees the best approach when it comes to tourism is for the industry to continue to think local.
More than 95% are small, micro, medium enterprises. We support that through encouraging food tourism, which is farm to table, and which will reduce import substitution, but encouraging them to go local.
That is Chris Cocker. He's the CEO of the South Pacific Tourism Organisation. That report from Bill Bainbridge. Memorial is being held in the Australian capital, Canberra, today for an academic whose work over nearly 50 years had a major influence on the understanding of PNG politics. Tributes have come from both Papua New Guinea and Australia for Dr. Bill Standish following his death late last month at the age of 74. He's been described as an expert analyst and a fearless commentator who provided generous support to young researchers, as Liam Fox reports.
Such was the depth of Bill Standish's connection to PNG's Chimbu province that locals put on a house cry or mourning gathering when they heard of his death.
The Chimbus are really missing him now. As soon as the news broke out that Bill Standish had died, there's a lot of people here who were in mourning and who rubbed mud over their faces and so on just to show the sadness for the loss of the great man.
Author Matthias Kinn first met Dr. Standish in the 1990s on one of his many field trips to Chimbu's capital, Kundiawa.
They say he was an anthropologist, but I call him a Chimbu scientist because he was a true friend of the Chimbu. And he had deep grassroots knowledge about Chimbu, and his network in Chimbu was really, really good. He had more knowledge about Chimbu than a lot of us ourselves in Chimbu.
Nearly 50 years ago, Dr. Standish left Canberra to take up a position as lecturer in politics at the University of Papua New Guinea. It was the start of a lifelong fascination with PNG, its people, its culture and politics, particularly the win-at-all-costs kind practiced in Chimbu and other parts of the volatile highlands. He would go on to write scholarly articles, book chapters, opinion pieces and blog posts focused on PNG politics at both the local and national levels. Ron May, Emeritus Fellow at the Department of Pacific Affairs at the Australian National University, has known him since the 1970s.
He did his fieldwork in Chimbu, and he was he spent a lot of time in the field and worked both at local and provincial and national levels. He was a very careful observer and documenter of what went on, and a very perceptive one.
He says not everyone appreciated Dr. Standish's honest accounts of the corruption and violence he witnessed during many elections in Chimbu.
He saw a lot of that earlier, the way that election roles could be subverted and pressure could be put on constituents to vote a certain way and so on. And then the corrupt behaviour of some of the politicians, including members of the government.
Not only did Dr. Standish have a huge influence on the understanding of PNG politics, but Dr. May says he was also a generous supporter of young academics.
A very caring sort of a character, and spent a lot of time helping other people with their research and just getting on with life generally.
He was a wonderful man. He's so interested to talk to people and share his knowledge, but also listen to Papua New Guineans about our own concerns about our country and also our hopes for our country.
Dr. Fiona Hukula has known Dr. Standish since the late 1990s, when she first started work at PNG's National Research Institute. She says his work and personality had a deep impact on many Papua New Guineans.
He's one of a group of academics who have this very deep connection and understanding of our country. So he's not only helped Australia in terms of understanding Papua New Guinea and Papua New Guinea politics, but I know that a lot of students that have studied politics in this country know of Bill's work.
That is Dr. Fiona Hukula. She's from the PNG National Research Institute, speaking about Dr. Bill Standish, who was an Australian academic but spent most of his life and career focused in on PNG and understanding that country's politics. He died late last month at the age of 74, and there will be a memorial today in Canberra for him. That report was from Liam Fox. Well, that's all for Pacific Beats this morning. I'm Catherine Grau. Thanks so much for your company. You have a great day.